figure in double exposure, superimposed on his background, out of place and scale. He doesn't belong here, thought Skerritt, because he doesn't look modern. That's what it is. He doesn't look modern, no matter what kind of pants he's wearing. He looks like something out of a Gothic cathedral. The patrician head held level, the fleshless face that had shrunk tighter together, the captain of a ship known by all, save the captain, to be sinking. Alva Skerritt had remained. He had not grasped that the events were real. He shuffled about in a stupor. He felt a fresh jolt of bewilderment each morning when he drove up to the building and saw the pickets. He suffered no injury beyond a few tomatoes hurled at his windshield. He tried to help Wynand. He tried to do his work and that of 5 other men, but he could not complete a normal day's task. He was going quietly to pieces, his joints wrenched loose by a question mark. He wasted everybody's time, interrupting anything to ask, "But why? Why? How, just like that, all of a sudden?" He saw a nurse in white uniform walking down the hall. An emergency first aid station had been established on the ground floor. He saw her carrying a wastebasket to the incinerator with wadded clumps of gauze, bloodstained. He turned away. He felt sick. It was not the sight, but the greater terror of an implication grasped by his instinct. This civilized building, secure in the neatness of waxed floors, respectable with the strict grooming of modern business, a place where one dealt in such rational matters as written words and trade contracts, where one accepted ads for baby garments and chatted about golf, had become in the span of a few days a place where one carried bloody refuse through the halls. Why? Thought Alva Skerritt. "I can't understand it," he droned in an accentless monotone to anyone around him. "I can't understand how Ellsworth got so much power, and Ellsworth's a man of culture, an idealist, not a dirty radical off a soapbox. He's so friendly and witty, and what an erudition! A man who jokes all the time is not a man of violence. Ellsworth didn't mean this. He didn't know what it would lead to. He loves people. I'd stake my shirt on Ellsworth, Tui." Once in Wynand's office, he ventured to say, "Gale, why don't you negotiate? Why don't you meet with them at least?" "Shut up." "But, Gale, there might be a bit of truth on their side, too. They're newspapermen. You know what they say, the freedom of the press." Then he saw the fit of fury he had expected for days, and had thought safely sidetracked. The blue irises vanishing in a white smear, the blind, luminous eyeballs in a face that was all cavities, the trembling hands. But in a moment, he saw what he had never witnessed before. He saw Wynand break the fit, without sound, without relief. He saw the sweat of the effort on the hollow temples, and the fists on the edge of the desk. "Alva, if I had not sat on the stairs of the Gazette for a week, where would be the press for them to be free on?" There were policemen outside, and in the halls of the building. It helped, but not much. One night, acid was thrown at the main entrance. It burned the big plate glass of the ground floor windows and left leprous spots on the walls. Sand in the bearings stopped one of the presses. An obscure delicatessen owner got his shop smashed for advertising in the Banner. A great many small advertisers withdrew. Wynand delivery trucks were wrecked. One driver was killed. The striking union of Wynand employees issued a protest against acts of violence. The union had not instigated them. Most of its members did not know who had. The New Frontiers said something about regrettable excesses, but ascribed them to spontaneous outbursts of justifiable popular anger. Homer Slattern, in the name of a group who called themselves the Liberal Businessmen, sent Wynand a notice canceling their advertising contracts. "You may sue us if you wish. We feel we have a legitimate cause for cancellation. We signed to advertise in a reputable newspaper, not in a sheet that has become a public disgrace, brings pickets to our doors, ruins our business, and is not being read by anybody." The group included most of the Banner's wealthiest advertisers. Gale Wynand stood at the window of his office and looked at his city. "I have supported strikes at a time when it was dangerous to do so. I have fought Gale Wynand all my life. I had never expected to see the day, or the issue, when I would be forced to say, as I say now, that I stand on the side of Gail Winand, wrote Austin Heller in the Chronicle. Winand sent him a note. God damn you, I didn't ask you to defend me. G.W. The New Frontiers described Austin Heller as a reactionary who has sold himself to big business. Intellectual Society ladies said that Austin Heller was old-fashioned. Gail Winand stood at a desk in the City Room and wrote editorials as usual. His derelict staff saw no change in him, no haste, no outbursts of anger. There was nobody to notice that some of his actions were new. He would go to the press room and stand looking at the white stream shot out of the roaring giants and listen to the sound. He would pick up a lead slug off the composing room floor and finger it absently on the palm of his hand like a piece of jade and lay it carefully on a table as if he did not want it to be wasted. He fought other forms of such waste, not noticing it, the gestures instinctive. He retrieved pencils. He spent a half hour, while telephones shrieked unanswered, repairing a typewriter that had broken down. It was not a matter of economy. He signed checks without looking at the figures. Skerritt was afraid to think of the amounts each passing day cost him. It was a matter of things that were part of the building, where he loved every doorknob, things that belonged to the banner, that belonged to him. Late each afternoon, he telephoned Dominique in the country. Fine. Everything under control. Don't listen to panic mongers. No, to hell with it. You know I don't want to talk about the damn paper. Tell me what the garden looks like. Did you go swimming today? Tell me about the lake. What dress are you wearing? Listen to WLX tonight at 8. They'll have your pet, Rachmaninoff's second concerto. Of course I have time to keep informed about everything. Oh, all right, I see one can't fool an ex-newspaper woman. I did go over the radio page. Of course we have plenty of help, it's just that I can't quite trust some of the new boys, and I had a moment to spare. Above all, don't come to town, you promise me that. Good night, dearest. He hung up and sat looking at the telephone, smiling. The thought of the countryside was like the thought of a continent beyond an ocean that could not be crossed. It gave him a sense of being locked in a besieged fortress, and he liked that. Not the fact, but the feeling. His face looked like a throwback to some distant ancestor who had fought on the ramparts of a castle. One evening he went out to the restaurant across the street. He had not eaten a complete meal for days. The streets were still light when he came back, the placid brown haze of summer, as if dulled sun rays remained stretched too comfortably on the warm air to undertake a movement of withdrawal, even though the sun had long since gone. It made the sky look fresh, and the street dirty. There were patches of brown and tired orange in the corners of old buildings. He saw pickets pacing in front of the banner's entrance. There were 8 of them, and they marched around and around in a long oval on the sidewalk. He recognized one boy, a police reporter. He had never seen any of the others. They carried signs. Tui Harding Allen Falk. The Freedom of the Press. Gail Winand Tramples Human Rights. His eyes kept following one woman. Her hips began at her ankles, bulging over the tight straps of her shoes. She had square shoulders and a long coat of cheap brown tweed over a huge square body. She had small white hands, the kind that would drop things all over the kitchen. She had an incision of a mouth without lips, and she waddled as she moved. But she moved with surprising briskness. Her steps defied the whole world to hurt her, with a malicious slyness that seemed to say she would like nothing better. Because what a joke it would be on the world if it tried to hurt her. Just try it and see. Just try it. Winand knew she had never been employed on the banner. She never could be. It did not appear likely that she could be taught to read. Her steps seemed to add that she jolly well didn't have to. She carried a sign. We demand... He thought of the nights when he had slept on the couch in the old banner building in the first years, because the new presses had to be paid for, and the banner had to be on the streets before its competitors. And he coughed blood one night and refused to see a doctor. But it turned out to be nothing, just exhaustion. He hurried into the building. The presses were rolling. He stood and listened for a while. At night the building was quiet. It seemed bigger, as if sound took space and vacated it. There were panels of light at open doors, between long stretches of dim hallways. A lone typewriter clicked somewhere, evenly, like a dripping faucet. Wynand walked through the halls. He thought that men had been willing to work for him when he plugged known crooks for municipal elections, when he glamorized red-light districts, when he ruined reputations by scandalous libel, when he sobbed over the mothers of gangsters. Talented men, respected men, had been eager to work for him. Now he was being honest for the first time in his career. He was leading his greatest crusade. With the help of finks, drifters, drunkards, and humble drudges too passive to quit. The guilt, he thought, was not perhaps with those who now refused to work for him. The sun hit the square crystal inkstand on his desk. It made Wynand think of a cool drink on a lawn, white clothes, the feel of grass under bare elbows. He tried not to look at the gay glitter and went on writing. It was a morning in the second week of the strike. He had retreated to his office for an hour and given orders not to be disturbed. He had an article to finish. He knew he wanted the excuse. 1 hour of not seeing what went on in the building. The door of his office opened without announcement, and Dominique came in. She had not been allowed to enter the Banner building since their marriage. He got up, a kind of quiet obedience in his movement, permitting himself no questions. She wore a coral linen suit. She stood as if the lake were behind her, and the sunlight rose from the surface to the folds of her clothes. She said, "Gail, I've come for my old job on the Banner." He stood looking at her silently. Then he smiled. It was a smile of convalescence. He turned to the desk, picked up the sheets he had written, handed them to her, and said, "Take this to the back room. Pick up the wire flimsies and bring them to me. Then report to Manning at the city desk." The impossible, the not to be achieved in word, glance, or gesture, the complete union of two beings in complete understanding, was done by a small stack of paper passing from his hand to hers. Their fingers did not touch. She turned and walked out of the office. Within 2 days, it was as if she had never left the staff of the Banner. Only now she did not write a column on houses, but kept busy wherever a competent hand was needed to fill a gap. "It's quite all right, Alva," she said to Scarrett. "It's a proper feminine job to be a seamstress. I'm here to slap on patches where necessary. And boy, is this cloth ripping fast. Just call me when one of your new journalists runs amuck more than usual." Scarrett could not understand her tone, her manner, or her presence. "You're a lifesaver, Dominique," he mumbled sadly. "It's like the old days seeing you here. And, oh, how I wish it were the old days. Only I can't understand. Gail wouldn't allow a photo of you in the place, when it was a decent, respectable place, and now, when it's practically as safe as a penitentiary during a convict riot, he lets you work here." "Can the commentaries, Alva? We haven't the time." She wrote a brilliant review of a movie she hadn't seen. She dashed off a report on a convention she hadn't attended. She batted out a string of recipes for the Daily Dishes column when the lady in charge failed to show up one morning. "I didn't know you could cook," said Scarrett. "I didn't either," said Dominique. She went out one night to cover a dock fire when it was found that the only man on duty had passed out on the floor of the men's room. "Good job," Wynand told her when he read the story. "But try that again and you'll get fired. If you want to stay, you're not to step out of the building." This was his only comment on her presence. He spoke to her when necessary, briefly and simply, as to any other employee. He gave orders. There were days when they did not have time to see each other. She slept on a couch in the library. Occasionally in the evening she would come to his office for a short rest, when they could take it, and then they talked, about nothing in particular, about small events of the day's work, gaily, like any married couple gossiping about the normal routine of their common life. They did not speak of Rourke or Cortland. She had noticed Rourke's picture on the wall of his office and asked, "When did you hang that up?" "Over a year ago." It had been their only reference to Rourke. They did not discuss the growing public fury against the Banner. They did not speculate on the future. They felt relief in forgetting the question beyond the walls of the building. It could be forgotten because it stood no longer as a question between them. It was solved and answered. What remained was the peace of the simplified. They had a job to do, the job of keeping a newspaper going, and they were doing it together. She would come in unsummoned in the middle of the night with a cup of hot coffee, and he would snatch it gratefully, not pausing in his work. He would find fresh sandwiches left on his desk when he needed them badly. He had no time to wonder where she got things. Then he discovered that she had established an electric plate and a stock of supplies in a closet. She cooked breakfast for him when he had to work all night. She came in carrying dishes on a piece of cardboard for a tray, with the silence of empty streets beyond the windows and the first light of morning on the rooftops. Once he found her, broom in hand, sweeping an office. The maintenance department had fallen apart. Charwomen appeared and disappeared. No one had time to notice. "Is that what I'm paying you for?" he asked. "Well, we can't work in a pigsty. I haven't asked you what you're paying me, but I want a raise." "Drop this thing for God's sake. It's ridiculous."
"What's ridiculous?"
"It's clean now. It didn't take me long."
"Is it a good job?"
"It's a good job." She leaned on the broom handle and laughed.
"I believe you thought, like everybody else, that I'm just a kind of luxury object. A high-class type of kept woman, didn't you, Gail?"
"Is this the way you can keep going when you want to?"
"This is the way I've wanted to keep going all my life. If I could find a reason for it."
He learned that her endurance was greater than his. She never showed a sign of exhaustion. He supposed that she slept, but he could not discover when. At any time, in any part of the building, not seeing him for hours, she was aware of him. She knew when he needed her most. Once he fell asleep, slumped across his desk. He awakened and found her looking at him. She had turned off the lights. She sat on a chair by the window in the moonlight, her face turned to him, calm, watching. Her face was the first thing he saw. Lifting his head painfully from his arm, in the first moment, before he could return fully to control and reality, he felt a sudden wrench of anger, helplessness, and desperate protest, not remembering what had brought them here, to this, remembering only that they were both caught in some vast, slow process of torture, and that he loved her. She had seen it in his face before he had completed the movement of straightening his body. She walked to him. She stood by his chair. She took his head and let it rest against her. She held him, and he did not resist, slumped in her arms. She kissed his hair. She whispered, "It will be all right, Gail. It will be all right." At the end of 3 weeks, Wynand walked out of the building one evening, not caring whether there would be anything left of it when he returned, and went to see Rourke. He had not telephoned Rourke since the beginning of the siege. Rourke telephoned him often. Wynand answered quietly, just answering, originating no statement, refusing to prolong the conversation. He had warned Rourke at the beginning, "Don't try to come here. I've given orders. You won't be admitted." He had to keep out of his mind the actual form which the issue of his battle could take. He had to forget the fact of Rourke's physical existence, because the thought of Rourke's person brought the thought of the county jail. He walked the long distance to the Enright house. Walking made the distance longer and safer. A ride in a cab would pull Rourke too close to the Banner building. He kept his glance slanted toward a point 6 feet ahead of him on the sidewalk. He did not want to look at the city. "Good evening, Gail," Rourke said calmly when he came in. "I don't know what's a more conspicuous form of bad discipline," said Wynand, throwing his hat down on a table by the door. "To blurt things right out or to ignore them blatantly. I look like hell. Say it." "You do look like hell. Sit down, rest, and don't talk. Then I'll run you a hot bath. No, you don't look that dirty, but it will be good for you for a change. Then we'll talk." Wynand shook his head and remained standing at the door. "Howard, the Banner is not helping you. It's ruining you." It had taken him 8 weeks to prepare himself to say that.
"Of course," said Rourke. "What of it?"
Wynand would not advance into the room.
"Gail, it doesn't matter as far as I'm concerned. I'm not counting on public opinion one way or the other."
You want me to give in?
I want you to hold out if it takes everything you own.
He saw that Wynand understood, that it was the thing Wynand had tried not to face, and that Wynand wanted him to speak.
I don't expect you to save me. I think I have a chance to win. The strike won't make it better or worse. Don't worry about me. And don't give in. If you stick to the end, you won't need me any longer.
He saw the look of anger, protest, and agreement. He added,
You know what I'm saying. We'll be better friends than ever. And you'll come to visit me in jail if necessary. Don't wince, and don't make me say too much. Not now. I'm glad of this strike. I knew that something like that had to happen when I saw you for the first time. You knew it long before that.
2 months ago, I promised you.
The one promise I wanted to keep. You're keeping it.
Don't you really want to despise me? I wish you'd say it now. I came here to hear it.
All right, listen. You have been the one encounter in my life that can never be repeated. There was Henry Cameron who died for my own cause. And you're the publisher of filthy tabloids, but I couldn't say this to him, and I'm saying it to you. There's Steve Mallory, who's never compromised with his soul, and you've done nothing but sell yours in every known way. But I couldn't say this to him, and I'm saying it to you. Is that what you've always wanted to hear from me? But don't give in.
He turned away and added,
That's all. We won't talk about your damn strike again. Sit down or get your drink. Rest. Get yourself out of looking like hell.
Wynand returned to the Banner late at night. He took a cab. It did not matter. He did not notice the distance. Dominique said, You've seen Rourke?
Yes. How do you know?
Here's the Sunday makeup. It's fairly lousy, but it'll have to do. I sent Manning home for a few hours. He was going to collapse. Jackson quit, but we can do without him. Alva's column was a mess. He can't even keep his grammar straight anymore. I rewrote it, but don't tell him. Tell him you did.
Go to sleep. I'll take Manning's place.
I'm good for hours.
They went on, and the days passed, and in the mailing room the piles of returns grew, running over into the corridor, white stacks of paper like marble slabs. Fewer copies of the Banner were run off with every edition, but the stacks kept growing. The days passed, days of heroic effort to put out a newspaper that came back unbought and unread. Chapter 16 In the glass-smooth mahogany of the long table reserved for the board of directors, there was a monogram in colored wood, G.W., reproduced from his signature. It had always annoyed the directors. They had no time to notice it now, but an occasional glance fell upon it, and then it was a glance of pleasure. The directors sat around the table. It was the first meeting in the board's history that had not been summoned by Wynand. But the meeting had convened, and Wynand had come. The strike was in its second month. Wynand stood by his chair at the head of the table. He looked like a drawing from a men's magazine, fastidiously groomed, a white handkerchief in the breast pocket of his dark suit. The directors caught themselves in peculiar thoughts. Some thought of British tailors, others of the House of Lords, of the Tower of London, of the executed English king. Or was it a chancellor? Who had died so well. They did not want to look at the man before them. They leaned upon visions of the pickets outside, of the perfumed, manicured women who shrieked their support of Ellsworth Toohey in drawing-room discussions, of the broad, flat face of a girl who paced Fifth Avenue with the placard, We Don't Read Wynand, for support and courage to say what they were saying. Wynand thought of a crumbling wall on the edge of the Hudson. He heard steps approaching blocks away. Only this time, there were no wires in his hand to hold his muscles ready.
It's gone beyond all sense. Is this a business organization or a charitable society for the defense of personal friends?
$300,000 last week. Never mind how I know it, Gail. No secret about it. Your banker told me.
All right, it's your money. But if you expect to get that back out of the sheet, let me tell you, we're wise to your smart tricks.
You're not going to saddle the corporation with that one, not a penny of it. You don't get away with it this time. It's too late, Gale. The day's past for your bright stunts.
Wynand looked at the fleshy lips of the man making sounds and thought, You've run the banner from the beginning. You didn't know it, but I know. It was you. It was your paper. There's nothing to save now.
Yes, Slaughtern and his bunch are willing to come back at once. All they ask is that we accept the union's demands, and they'll pick up the balance of their contracts on the old terms, even without waiting for you to rebuild circulation. Which will be some job, friend, let me tell you. And I think that's pretty white of them. I spoke to Homer yesterday, and he gave me his word. Care to hear me name the sums involved, Wynand? Or do you know it without my help?
No, Senator Eldridge wouldn't see you.
Oh, skip it, Gale. We know you flew to Washington last week. What you don't know is that Senator Eldridge is going around saying he wouldn't touch this with a 10-foot pole. And Boss Craig suddenly got called out to Florida, did he? To sit up with a sick aunt?
None of them will pull you out of this one, Gale. This isn't a road-paving deal or a little watered stock scandal. And you ain't what you used to be.
Wynand thought, I never used to be. I've never been here. Why are you afraid to look at me? Don't you know that I'm the least among you? The half-naked women in the Sunday supplement, the babies in the rotogravure section, the editorials on park squirrels, they were your souls given expression. The straight stuff of your souls. But where was mine?
I'll be damned if I can see any sense to it. Now, if they were demanding a raise in wages, that I could understand. I'd say fight the bastards for all we're worth. But what's this, a goddamn intellectual issue of some kind? Are we losing our shirts for principles or something?
Don't you understand? The Banner's a church publication now. Mr. Gale Wynand, the evangelist. We're over a barrel, but we've got ideals.
Now, if it were a real issue, a political issue, but some fool dynamiter who's blown up some dump, everybody's laughing at us.
Honest, Wynand, I've tried to read your editorials, and if you want my honest opinion, it's the lousiest stuff ever put in print. You'd think you were writing for college professors.
Wynand thought, I know you. You're the one who'd give money to a pregnant slut, but not to a starving genius. I've seen your face before. I picked you and I brought you in. When in doubt about your work, remember that man's face. You're writing for him.
But, Mr. Wynand, we can't remember his face.
One can, child. One can. It will come back to remind you. It will come back and demand payment. And I'll pay. I signed a blank check long ago, and now it's presented for collection. But a blank check is always made out to the sum of everything you've got.
The situation is medieval and a disgrace to democracy.
The voice whined. It was Mitchell Layton speaking.
It's about time somebody had some say around here. One man running all those papers as he damn pleases. What is this, the 19th century?
Layton pouted.
He looked somewhere in the direction of a banker across the table.
Has anybody here ever bothered to inquire about my ideas? I've got ideas. We've all got to pool ideas. What I mean is teamwork. One big orchestra. It's about time this paper had a modern liberal progressive policy. For instance, take the question of the sharecroppers.
Shut up, Mitch, said Alvis Skerritt. Skerritt had drops of sweat running down his temples. He didn't know why. He wanted the board to win. There was just something in the room. It's too hot in here, he thought. I wish somebody'd open a window.
I won't shut up, shrieked Mitchell Layton. I'm just as good as...
Please, Mr. Layton, said the banker.
All right, said Layton. All right, don't forget who holds the biggest hunk of stock next to Superman here.
He jerked his thumb at Wynand, not looking at him.
And don't forget it. Just you guess who's going to run things around here.
Gale, said Alvis Skerritt, looking up at Wynand, his eyes strangely honest and tortured.
Gale, it's no use. But we can save the pieces. Look, if we just admit that we were wrong about Cortland, and if we just take Harding back, he's a valuable man, and maybe Toohey.
No one is to mention the name of Toohey in this discussion, said Wynand.
Mitchell Layton snapped his mouth open and dropped it shut again.
That's it, Gale, cried Alvis Skerritt. That's great. We can bargain and make them an offer. We'll reverse our policy on Cortland.
That we've got to, not for the damn union, but we've got to rebuild circulation, Gale. So we'll offer them that, and we'll take Harding, Allen, and Falk, but not to... not Ellsworth. We give in, and they give in. Saves everybody's face. Is that it, Gale?
Wynand said nothing.
I think that's it, Mr. Skerritt, said the banker.
I think that's the solution. After all, Mr. Wynand must be allowed to maintain his prestige. We can sacrifice a columnist and keep peace among ourselves.
I don't see it, yelled Mitchell Layton. I don't see it at all. Why should we sacrifice Mr. a great liberal just because?
I stand with Mr. Skerritt, said the man who had spoken of senators, and the voices of the others seconded him, and the man who had criticized the editorials said suddenly in the general noise,
I think Gale Wynand was a hell of a swell boss after all.
There was something about Mitchell Layton which he didn't want to see. Now he looked at Wynand for protection. Wynand did not notice him.
Gale? Asked Skerritt.
Gale, what do you say?
There was no answer.
God damn it, Wynand, it's now or never. This can't go on. Make up your mind or get out. I'll buy you out, shrieked Layton. Want to sell? Want to sell and get the hell out of it?
For God's sake, Wynand, don't be a fool.
Gale, it's the banner, whispered Skerritt. It's our banner.
We'll stand by you, Gale. We'll all chip in. We'll pull the old paper back on its feet. We'll do as you say. You'll be the boss. But for God's sake, act like a boss now.
Quiet, gentlemen, quiet. Wynand, this is final. We switch policy on Cortland, we take Harding, Allen, and Falk back, and we save the wreck. Yes or no?
There was no answer.
Wynand, you know it's that, or you have to close the banner. You can't keep this up, even if you bought us all out. Give in, or close the banner. You had better give in.
Wynand heard that. He had heard it through all the speeches. He had heard it for days before the meeting. He knew it better than any man present. Close the banner. He saw a single picture. The new masthead rising over the door of the Gazette.
You had better give in.
He made a step back. It was not a wall behind him. It was only the side of his chair. He thought of the moment in his bedroom when he had almost pulled a trigger. He knew he was pulling it now.
All right, he said.
It's only a bottle cap, thought Wynand, looking down at a speck of glitter under his feet. A bottle cap ground into the pavement. The pavements of New York are full of things like that. Bottle caps, safety pins, campaign buttons, sink chains, sometimes lost jewels. It's all alike now, flattened, ground in. It makes the pavement sparkle at night, the fertilizer of a city. Someone drank the bottle empty and threw the cap away. How many cars have passed over it? Could one retrieve it now? Could one kneel and dig with bare hands and tear it out again? I had no right to hope for escape. I had no right to kneel and seek redemption. Millions of years ago when the earth was being born, there were living things like me. Flies caught in resin that became amber. Animals caught in ooze that became rock. I am a man of the 20th century, and I became a bit of tin in the pavements for the trucks of New York to roll over. He walked slowly, the collar of his topcoat raised. The street stretched before him empty, and the buildings ahead were like the backs of books lining a shelf, assembled without order, of all sizes. The corners he passed led to black channels. Street lamps gave the city a protective cover, but it cracked in spots. He turned a corner, when he saw a slant of light ahead. It was a goal for three or four blocks. The light came from the window of a pawn shop. The shop was closed, but a glaring bulb hung there to discourage looters who might be reduced to this. He stopped and looked at it. He thought the most indecent sight on earth, a pawn shop window. The things which had been sacred to men, and the things which had been precious, surrendered to the sight of all, to the pawing and the bargaining, trash to the indifferent eyes of strangers. The equality of a junk heap, typewriters and violins, the tools of dreams, old phonographs and wedding rings, the tags of love,
together with soiled trousers, coffee pots, ashtrays, pornographic plastic figures. The refuse of despair. Pledged, not sold, not cut off in clean finality, but hocked to a stillborn hope never to be redeemed. "Hello, Gail Winand," he said to the things in the window, and walked on. He felt an iron grate under his feet, and an odor struck him in the face, an odor of dust, sweat, and dirty clothing, worse than the smell of stockyards, because it had a homey, normal quality, like decomposition made routine. The grating of a subway. He thought, this is the residue of many people put together, of human bodies pressed into a mass with no space to move, with no air to breathe. This is the sum, even though down there among the packed flesh, one can find the smell of starched white dresses, of clean hair, of healthy young skin. Such is the nature of sums and of quests for the lowest common denominator. What then is the residue of many human minds put together, unaired, unspaced, undifferentiated? The banner, he thought, and walked on. My city, he thought, the city I loved, the city I thought I ruled. He had walked out of the board meeting. He had said, take over, Alva, until I come back. He had not stopped to see Manning drunk with exhaustion at the city desk, nor the people in the city room, still functioning, waiting, knowing what was being decided in the boardroom. Nor Dominique. Skerritt would tell them. He had walked out of the building and gone to his penthouse and sat alone in the bedroom without windows. Nobody had come to disturb him. When he left the penthouse, it was safe to go out. It was dark. He passed a newsstand and saw late editions of the afternoon papers announcing the settlement of the Winand strike. The union had accepted Skerritt's compromise. He knew that Skerritt would take care of all the rest. Skerritt would replate the front page of tomorrow's banner. Skerritt would write the editorial that would appear on the front page. He thought the presses are rolling right now. Tomorrow morning's banner will be out on the streets in an hour. He walked at random. He owned nothing. But he was owned by any part of the city. It was right that the city should now direct his way, and that he should be moved by the pull of chance corners. Here I am, my masters. I am coming to salute you and acknowledge wherever you want me. I shall go as I'm told. I'm the man who wanted power. That woman sitting on the stoop of an old brownstone house, her fat white knees spread apart. The man pushing the white brocade of his stomach out of a cab in front of a great hotel. The little man sipping root beer at a drugstore counter, the woman leaning over a stained mattress on the sill of a tenement window, the taxi driver parked on a corner, the lady with orchids, drunk at the table of a sidewalk cafe, the toothless woman selling chewing gum, the man in shirt sleeves leaning against the door of a pool room, they are my masters, my owners, my rulers without a face. Stand here, he thought, and count the lighted windows of a city. You cannot do it. But behind each yellow rectangle that climbs, one over another, to the sky, under each bulb, down to there, see that spark over the river, which is not a star? There are people whom you will never see, and who are your masters. At the supper tables, in the drawing rooms, in their beds and in their cellars, in their studies and in their bathrooms, speeding in the subways under your feet, crawling up in elevators through vertical cracks around you, jolting past you in every bus, your masters. Gail Winand. There is a net, longer than the cables that coil through the walls of this city, larger than the mesh of pipes that carry water, gas, and refuse. There is another hidden net around you. It is strapped to you, and the wires lead to every hand in the city. They jerked the wires, and you moved. You were a ruler of men. You held a leash. A leash is only a rope with a noose at both ends. My masters. The anonymous, the unselected. They gave me a penthouse, an office, a yacht. To them, to any one of them who wished, for the sum of 3 cents, I sold Howard Rourke. He walked past an open marble court, a cave cut deep into a building, filled with light, spurting the sudden cold of air conditioning. It was a movie theater, and the marquee had letters made of rainbows, Romeo and Juliet. A placard stood by the glass column of the box office. Bill Shakespeare's immortal classic. But there's nothing highbrow about it. Just a simple human love story. A boy from the Bronx meets a girl from Brooklyn, just like the folks next door, just like you and me. He walked past the door of a saloon. There was a smell of stale beer. A woman sat slumped, breasts flattened against the tabletop. A jukebox played Wagner's Song to the Evening Star, adapted in swing time. He saw the trees of Central Park. He walked, his eyes lowered. He was passing by the Aquitania Hotel. He came to a corner. He had escaped other corners like it, but this one caught him. It was a dim corner, a slice of sidewalk trapped between the wall of a closed garage and the pillars of an elevated station. He saw the rear end of a truck disappearing down the street. He had not seen the name on it, but he knew what truck it was. A newsstand, crouched under the iron stairs of the elevated. He moved his eyes slowly. The fresh pile was there, spread out for him. Tomorrow's banner. He did not come closer. He stood waiting. He thought, I still have a few minutes in which not to know. He saw faceless people stopping at the stand, one after another. They came in for different papers, but they bought the banner also when they noticed its front page. He stood pressed to the wall, waiting. He thought, it is right that I should be the last to learn what I have said. Then he could delay no longer. No customers came. The stand stood deserted, papers spread in the yellow light of a bulb, waiting for him. He could see no vendor in the black hovel beyond the bulb. The street was empty. A long corridor, filled by the skeleton of the elevated. Stone paving, blotched walls, the interlacing of iron pillars. There were lighted windows, but they looked as if no people moved inside the walls. A train thundered over his head, a long roll of clangor that went shuddering down the pillars into the earth. It looked like an aggregation of metal rushing, without human driver, through the night. He waited for the sound to die, then he walked to the stand. The banner, he said. He did not see who sold him the paper, whether it was a man or a woman. He saw only a gnarled brown hand pushing the copy forward. He started walking away, but stopped while crossing the street. There was a picture of Rourke on the front page. It was a good picture, the calm face, the sharp cheekbones, the implacable mouth. He read the editorial, leaning against a pillar of the elevated. We have always endeavored to give our readers the truth without fear or prejudice. Charitable consideration and the benefit of the doubt, even to a man charged with an outrageous crime. But after conscientious investigation, and in the light of new evidence placed before us, we find ourselves obliged honestly to admit that we might have been too lenient. A society awakened to a new sense of responsibility toward the underprivileged. We join the voice of public opinion. The past, the career, the personality of Howard Rourke seem to support the widespread impression that he is a reprehensible character, a dangerous, unprincipled, antisocial type of man. If found guilty, as seems inevitable, Howard Rourke must be made to bear the fullest penalty the law can impose on him. It was signed Gail Winand. When he looked up, he was in a brightly lighted street on a trim sidewalk, looking at a wax figure exquisitely contorted on a satin chaise longue in a shop window. The figure wore a salmon-colored negligee, lucite sandals, and a string of pearls suspended from one raised finger. He did not know when he had dropped the paper. It was not in his hands any longer. He glanced back. It would be impossible to find a discarded paper lying on some street he did not know he had passed. He thought, what for? There are other papers like it. The city is full of them. You have been the one encounter in my life that can never be repeated. Howard, I wrote that editorial 40 years ago. I wrote it one night when I was 16 and stood on the roof of a tenement. He walked on. Another street lay before him, a sudden cut of long emptiness and a chain of green traffic lights strung out to the horizon, like a rosary without end. He thought, now walk from green bead to green bead. He thought, these are not the words, but the words kept ringing with his steps. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. He went past a window of old shoes corroded by wear, past the door of a mission with a cross above it, past the peeling poster of a political candidate who ran 2 years ago, past a grocery store with barrels of rotting greens on the sidewalk. The streets were contracting, walls drawing closer together. He could smell the odor of the river, and there were wads of fog over the rare lights. he was in Hell's Kitchen. The facades of the buildings around him were like the walls of secret backyards, suddenly exposed. Decay without reticence, past the need of privacy or shame. He heard shrieks coming from a saloon on a corner. He could not tell whether it was joy or brawling. He stood in the middle of a street. He looked slowly down the mouth of every dark crevice, up the streaked walls, to the windows, to the roofs. I never got out of here. I never got out. I surrendered to the grocery man, to the deckhands on the ferry boat, to the owner of the pool room. You don't run things around here. You don't run things around here. You've never run things anywhere, Gale Winand. You've only added yourself to the things they ran. Then he looked up across the city to the shapes of the great skyscrapers. He saw a string of lights rising unsupported in black space, a glowing pinnacle anchored to nothing, a small brilliant square hanging detached in the sky. He knew the famous buildings to which these belonged. He could reconstruct their forms in space. He thought, "You're my judges and witnesses. You rise unhindered above the sagging roofs. You shoot your gracious tension to the stars out of the slack, the tired, the accidental. The eyes, 1 mile out on the ocean, will see none of this, and none of this will matter. But you will be the presence and the city. As down the centuries a few men stand in lonely rectitude, that we may look and say, there is a human race behind us. One can't escape from you. The streets change, but one looks up and there you stand, unchanged. You have seen me walking through the streets tonight. You have seen all my steps and all my years. It's you that I've betrayed. For I was born to be one of you." He walked on. It was late. Circles of light lay undisturbed on the empty sidewalks under the lampposts. The horns of taxis shrieked once in a while like doorbells ringing through the corridors of a vacant interior. He saw discarded newspapers as he passed, on the pavements, on park benches, in the wire trash baskets on corners. Many of them were the banner. Many copies of the banner had been read in the city tonight. He thought, "We're building circulation, Alva." He stopped. He saw a paper spread out in the gutter before him, front page up. It was the banner. He saw Rourke's picture. He saw the gray print of a rubber heel across Rourke's face. He bent, his body folding itself down slowly, with both knees, both arms, and picked up the paper. He folded the front page and put it in his pocket. He walked on. An unknown rubber heel, somewhere in the city, on an unknown foot, that I released to march. I released them all. I made every one of those who destroyed me. There is a beast on earth, damned safely by its own impotence. I broke the dam. They would have remained helpless. They can produce nothing. I gave them the weapon. I gave them my strength, my energy, my living power. I created a great voice and let them dictate the words. The woman who threw the beet leaves in my face had a right to do it. I made it possible for her. Anything may be betrayed. Anyone may be forgiven. But not those who lack the courage of their own greatness. Alva Skerritt can be forgiven. He had nothing to betray. Mitchell Layton can be forgiven, but not I. I was not born to be a second-hander. Chapter 17. It was a summer day, cloudless and cool, as if the sun was screened by an invisible film of water, and the energy of heat had been transformed into a sharper clarity, an added brilliance of outline for the buildings of the city. In the streets, scattered like scraps of gray foam, there were a great many copies of the banner. The city read, chuckling, the statement of Winand's renunciation.
"That's that," said Gus Webb, chairman of the We Don't Read Winand committee.
"It's slick," said Ike.
"I'd like one peek, just one peek at the great Mr. Gale Winand's face today," said Sally Brent.
"It's about time," said Homer Slaughtern.
"Isn't it splendid? Winand surrendered," said a tight-lipped woman.
She knew little about Winand and nothing about the issue, but she liked to hear of people surrendering. In a kitchen after dinner, a fat woman scraped the remnants off the dishes onto a sheet of newspaper. She never read the front page, only the installments of a love serial in the second section.
she wrapped onion peelings and lamb chop bones in a copy of the banner.
"It's stupendous," said Lancelot Cloakie. "Only I'm really sore at that union, Ellsworth. How could they double-cross you like that?"
"Don't be a sap, Lance," said Ellsworth Toohey.
"What do you mean?"
"I told them to accept the terms."
"You did?"
"Yep."
"But Jesus, one small voice."
"You can wait for one small voice another month or so, can't you? I filed suit with the labor board today to be reinstated in my job on the banner. There are more ways than one to skin a cat, Lance. The skinning isn't important once you've broken its spine."
That evening, Rourke pressed the bell button on the door of Winand's penthouse. The butler opened the door and said, "Mr. Winand cannot see you, Mr. Rourke." From the sidewalk across the street, Rourke looked up and saw a square of light high over the roofs in the window of Winand's study. In the morning, Rourke came to Winand's office in the Banner building. Winand's secretary told him,
"Mr. Winand cannot see you, Mr. Rourke."
She added, her voice polite, disciplined,
"Mr. Winand has asked me to tell you that he does not wish ever to see you again."
Rourke wrote him in a long letter. "Gale, I know. I hoped you could escape it, but since it had to happen, start again from where you are. I know what you're doing to yourself. You're not doing it for my sake. It's not up to me, but if this will help you, I want to say that I'm repeating now everything I've ever said to you. Nothing has changed for me. You're still what you were. I'm not saying that I forgive you, because there can be no such question between us. But if you can't forgive yourself, will you let me do it? Let me say that it doesn't matter. It's not the final verdict on you. Give me the right to let you forget it. Go on, just on my faith, until you've recovered. I know it's something no man can do for another, but if I am what I've been to you, you'll accept it. Call it a blood transfusion. You need it. Take it. It's harder than fighting that strike. Do it for my sake, if that will help you. But do it. Come back. There will be another chance. What you think you've lost can neither be lost nor found. Don't let it go." The letter came back to Rourke unopened. Alva Skerritt ran the banner. Winand sat in his office. He had removed Rourke's picture from the wall. He attended to advertising contracts, expenses, accounts. Skerritt took care of the editorial policy. Winand did not read the contents of the banner. When Winand appeared in any department of the building, the employees obeyed him as they had obeyed him before. He was still a machine, and they knew that it was a machine more dangerous than ever, a car running downhill, without combustion or brakes. He slept in his penthouse. He had not seen Dominique. Skerritt had told him that she had gone back to the country. Once Winand ordered his secretary to telephone Connecticut. He stood by her desk while she asked the butler whether Mrs. Winand was there. The butler answered that she was. The secretary hung up, and Winand went back to his office. He thought he would give himself a few days. Then he'd return to Dominique. Their marriage would be what she had wanted it to be at first, Mrs. Winand Papers. He would accept it. "Wait," he thought in an agony of impatience. "Wait. You must learn to face her as you are now. Train yourself to be a beggar. There must be no pretense at things to which you have no right, no equality, no resistance, no pride in holding your strength against hers, only acceptance now. Stand before her as a man who can give her nothing, who will live on what she chooses to grant him. It will be contempt, but it will come from her, and it will be a bond. Show her that you recognize this. There is a kind of dignity in a renunciation of dignity openly admitted. Learn it. Wait." He sat in the study of his penthouse, his head on the arm of his chair. There were no witnesses in the empty rooms around him. "Dominique," he thought, "I will have no claim to make except that I need you so much, and that I love you. I told you once not to consider it. Now I'll use it as a tin cup, but I'll use it. I love you." Dominique lay stretched out on the shore of the lake. She looked at the house on the hill, at the tree branches above her. Flat on her back, hands crossed under her head, she studied the motion of leaves against the sky. It was an earnest occupation, giving her full contentment. She thought it's a lovely kind of green. There's a difference between the color of plants and the color of objects. This has light in it. This is not just green, but also the living force of the tree made visible. I don't have to look down. I can see the branches, the trunk, the roots, just by looking at that color. That fire around the edges is the sun. I don't have to see it. I can tell what the whole countryside looks like today. The spots of light weaving in circles, that's the lake. The special kind of light that comes refracted from water. The lake is beautiful today, and it's better not to see it, just to guess by these spots. I've never been able to enjoy it before, the sight of the earth. It's such a great background, but it has no meaning except as a background. And I thought of those who owned it, and then it hurt me too much. I can love it now. They don't own it. They own nothing. They've never won. I have seen the life of Gale Winand, and now I know. One cannot hate the earth in their name. The earth is beautiful. And it is a background. But not theirs. She knew what she had to do. But she would give herself a few days. She thought, I've learned to bear anything except happiness. I must learn how to carry it, how not to break under it. It's the only discipline I'll need from now on. Rourke stood at the window of his house in Monadnock Valley. He had rented the house for the summer. He went there when he wanted loneliness and rest. It was a quiet evening. The window opened on a small ledge in a frame of trees, hanging against the sky. A strip of sunset light stretched above the dark treetops. He knew that there were houses below, but they could not be seen. He was as grateful as any other tenant for the way in which he had built this place. He heard the sound of a car approaching up the road at the other side. He listened, astonished. He expected no guests. The car stopped. He walked to open the door. He felt no astonishment when he saw Dominique. She came in as if she had left this house half an hour ago. She wore no hat, no stockings, just sandals and a dress intended for backcountry roads, a narrow sheath of dark blue linen with short sleeves, like a smock for gardening. She did not look as if she had driven across three states, but as if she were returning from a walk down the hill. He knew that this was to be the solemnity of the moment, that it needed no solemnity. It was not to be stressed and set apart. It was not this particular evening, but the completed meaning of 7 years behind them. Howard. He stood as if he were looking at the sound of his name in the room. He had all he had wanted. But there was one thought that remained as pain even now. He said, Dominique, wait till he recovers. You know he won't recover. Have a little pity on him. Don't speak their language. He had no choice. He could have closed the paper. It was his life. This is mine. He did not know that Winand had said once, all love is exception-making. And Winand would not know that Rourke had loved him enough to make his greatest exception, one moment when he had tried to compromise. Then he knew it was useless, like all sacrifices. What he said was his signature under her decision. I love you. She looked about the room to let the ordinary reality of walls and chairs help her keep the discipline she had been learning for this moment. The walls he had designed, the chairs he used, a package of his cigarettes on the table, the routine necessities of life that could acquire splendor when life became what it was now. Howard, I know what you intend to do at the trial, so it won't make any difference if they learn the truth about us.
It won't make any difference.
When you came that night and told me about Cortland, I didn't try to stop you. I knew you had to do it. It was your time to set the terms on which you could go on. This is my time, my Cortland explosion. You must let me do it my way. Don't question me. Don't protect me. No matter what I do.
I know what you'll do.
You know that I have to?
Yes.
She bent one arm from the elbow, fingers lifted, in a short backward jolt, as if tossing the subject over her shoulder. It was settled and not to be discussed. She turned away from him. She walked across the room to let the casual ease of her steps make this her home,
to state that his presence was to be the rule for all her coming days, and she had no need to do what she wanted most at this moment, stand and look at him. She knew also what she was delaying, because she was not ready and would never be ready. She stretched her hand out for his package of cigarettes on the table. His fingers closed over her wrist, and he pulled her hand back. He pulled her around to face him, and then he held her, and his mouth was on hers. She knew that every moment of 7 years when she had wanted this and stopped the pain and thought she had won was not past, had never been stopped, had lived on, stored, adding hunger to hunger, and now she had to feel it all, the touch of his body, the answer and the waiting together. She didn't know whether her discipline had helped. Not too well, she thought, because she saw that he had lifted her in his arms, carried her to a chair and sat down holding her on his knees. He laughed without sound, as he would have laughed at a child, but the firmness of his hands holding her showed concern and a kind of steadying caution. Then it seemed simple. She had nothing to hide from him. She whispered, "Yes, Howard, that much." And he said, "It was very hard for me, all these years." And the years were ended. She slipped down to sit on the floor, her elbows propped on his knees. She looked up at him and smiled, and she knew that she could not have reached this white serenity except as the sum of all the colors, of all the violence she had known. "Howard, willingly, completely, and always, without reservations, without fear of anything they can do to you or me, in any way you wish, as your wife or your mistress, secretly or openly, here or in a furnished room I'll take in some town near a jail, where I'll see you through a wire net, it won't matter. Howard, if you win the trial, even that won't matter too much. You've won long ago. I'll remain what I am, and I'll remain with you, now and ever, in any way you want." He held her hands in his. She saw his shoulders sagging down to her. She saw him helpless, surrendered to this moment, as she was. And she knew that even pain can be confessed. But to confess happiness is to stand naked, delivered to the witness. Yet they could let each other see it without need of protection. It was growing dark. The room was indistinguishable. Only the window remained, and his shoulders against the sky in the window. She awakened with the sun in her eyes. She lay on her back, looking at the ceiling as she had looked at the leaves. Not to move. To guess by hints. To see everything through the greater intensity of implication. The broken triangles of light on the angular molding of the ceiling's plastic tiles meant that it was morning, and that this was a bedroom at Monadnock, the geometry of fire and structure above her, designed by him. The fire was white. That meant it was very early, and the rays came through clean country air, with nothing anywhere in space between this bedroom and the sun. The weight of the blanket, heavy and intimate on her naked body, was everything that had been last night. And the skin she felt against her arm was Rourke asleep beside her. She slipped out of bed. She stood at the window, her arms raised, holding on to the frame at each side. She thought if she looked back, she would see no shadow of her body on the floor. She felt as if the sunlight went straight through her because her body had no weight. But she had to hurry before he awakened. She found his pajamas in a dresser drawer and put them on. She went to the living room, closing the door carefully behind her. She picked up the telephone and asked for the nearest sheriff's office. "This is Mrs. Gail Winant," she said. "I'm speaking from the house of Mr. Howard Rourke at Monadnock Valley. I wish to report that my Star Sapphire ring was stolen here last night. About $5,000. It was a present from Mr. Rourke. Can you get here within an hour? Thank you." She went to the kitchen, made coffee, and stood watching the glow of the electric coil under the coffee pot, thinking that it was the most beautiful light on earth. She set the table by the large window in the living room. He came out, wearing nothing but a dressing gown, and laughed at the sight of her in his pajamas. She said, "Don't dress. Sit down. Let's have breakfast." They were finishing when they heard the sound of the car stopping outside. She smiled and walked to open the door. There were a sheriff, a deputy, and two reporters from local papers. "Good morning,"
said Dominique. Come in.
Mrs. Winand, said the sheriff.
That's right, Mrs. Gale Winand. Come in, sit down.
In the ludicrous folds of the pajamas, with dark cloth bulging over a belt wound tightly, with sleeves hanging over her fingertips, she had all the poised elegance she displayed in her best hostess gown. She was the only one who seemed to find nothing unusual in the situation. The sheriff held a notebook, as if he did not know what to do with it. She helped him to find the right questions, and answered them precisely, like a good newspaper woman.
It was a star sapphire ring set in platinum. I took it off and left it here on this table, next to my purse, before going to bed. It was about 10 o'clock last night. When I got up this morning, it was gone. Yes, this window was open.
No, we didn't hear anything.
No, it was not insured. I have not had the time. Mr. Rourke gave it to me recently.
No, there are no servants here, and no other guests.
Yes, please look through the house. Living room, bedroom, bathroom, and kitchen.
Yes, of course, you may look too, gentlemen.
The press, I believe.
Do you wish to ask me any questions?
There were no questions to ask. The story was complete. The reporters had never seen a story of this nature offered in this manner. She tried not to look at Rourke after her first glance at his face, but he kept his promise. He did not try to stop her or protect her. When questioned, he answered, enough to support her statements. Then the men departed. They seemed glad to leave. Even the sheriff knew that he would not have to conduct a search for that ring. Dominique said,
I'm sorry. I know it was terrible for you, but it was the only way to get it into the papers.
You should have told me which one of your star sapphires I gave you.
I never had any. I don't like star sapphires.
That was a more thorough job of dynamiting than Cortland.
Yes. Now Gale is blasted over to the side where he belongs. So he thinks you're an unprincipled antisocial type of man. Now let him see the banner smearing me also. Why should he be spared that? Sorry, Howard. I don't have your sense of mercy. I've read that editorial. Don't comment on this. Don't say anything about self-sacrifice, or I'll break, and I'm not quite as strong as that sheriff is probably thinking. I didn't do it for you. I've made it worse for you. I've added scandal to everything else they'll throw at you. But, Howard, now we stand together, against all of them. You'll be a convict, and I'll be an adulteress. Howard, do you remember that I was afraid to share you with lunch wagons and strangers' windows? Now I'm not afraid to have this past night smeared all over their newspapers. My darling, do you see why I'm happy? And why I'm free?
He said, I'll never remind you afterward that you're crying, Dominique.
The story, including the pajamas, the dressing gown, the breakfast table, and the single bed, was in all the afternoon papers of New York that day. Alva Skerritt walked into Winand's office and threw a newspaper down on his desk. Skerritt had never discovered how much he loved Winand until now, and he was so hurt that he could express it only in furious abuse. He gulped,
God damn you, you blasted fool, it serves you right. It serves you right, and I'm glad, damn you witless soul. Now what are we going to do?
Winand read the story and sat looking at the paper. Skerritt stood before the desk. Nothing happened. It was just an office. A man sat at a desk holding a newspaper. He saw Winand's hands, one at each side of the sheet, and the hands were still. No,